This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. J.C. Kane producing. A few more minutes with Troy Hebert and Melissa Flournoy. And let's go to John calling from Denver, Colorado, I believe. John, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hey, Jim. I'm from Baton Rouge. I'm just visiting in Denver and listening on the app. My comment is regarding the fact that education is not a one-fits-all solution. I'm an example. I got a bachelor's degree paid for and an ROTC scholarship, a master's paid for, on a state senate internship in Florida, a PhD paid for by the geography department at LSU. My parents wonder how I ever did any of that. So my point is, there's no one solution that works for everybody. So legislators should focus on helping to create opportunities rather than trying to come up with single solutions. That's it. Thank you.
Troy Hebert, would you respond, please?
Well, I think it brings up a good point, and I think your caller before that talked about the high cost of education. You know, I went to trade school, I guess 30 years ago, 35 years ago, and it only cost me my books. I went to diesel mechanic school and got a good trade. But you know what's driving the cost of education, you know, and I'll issue a challenge on your show this morning to any investigative reporter in the state to look into exactly how many hours a college professor actually works a week. And how much they get paid and how little they actually work. And that is what's driving the high cost of education. If you look at tuition increase, it far outpaces inflation. And so what your caller was trying to say is they overpricing the product that they're providing.
All right. Well, before you go away, I want Melissa to respond. Do you think?
Yeah, I was about to say, you're barking up the wrong tree there, Troy. I mean, I'll tell you that at least at LSU, and I've been on the faculty off and on at LSU as an adjunct professor for years, the faculty that are on tenure-track positions that are paid for full-time work way more than full-time between teaching their classes, preparing for classes, and then the pressure to write articles and books and publish. I mean, you know, the college professors, at least at LSU that I know, are not sitting around eating bonbons and whatever. So, you know, and that sort of rate, and some of those are working full-time and not making nearly enough.
All right. We've got short duration here with our historian Benjamin Runkle on deck. But, Troy, I wanted you to get a final word since Melissa debunked your statement. What do you think?
Well, she debunked it as an opinion. She offers no facts, and that's why I say, why don't an investigative reporter go out and look for some facts and see exactly how little they work? And I think Melissa would be surprised, as well as a lot of your listeners, and you'll see an issue that is driving the high cost of education.
All right. I think Melissa would respectfully disagree. Nicholas on Nicholson says, when I went to Columbia U in 1958, I paid $20 per credit, but the minimum salary then was $1 per hour. College was always expensive, writes Nicholas. And now we're joined by Benjamin Runkle, historian and former paratrooper, presidential speechwriter, Harvard PhD, Bronze Star, by the way, from Operation Iraqi Freedom. He obviously has an affiliation and an affinity for the military, and he goes back to World War II, generals in the making. Some great photos of our world leaders, national icons on the cover, Marshall, Eisenhower, and Patton, and they were the commanders who won World War II. And Professor Runkle, it is interesting that you go back to a time that few others have. We know a lot about Eisenhower and Patton and Marshall during World War II, but there hasn't been a great deal written about how they got to where they were at that time. You go there. It was a fascinating voyage for you, I'm sure.
It definitely, Jim. Good morning. And it was definitely, I became first interested in this topic when I was a first lieutenant with the 82nd Airborne and read that the United States Army only had the 17th largest army in the world at the beginning of World War II in 1939. And that's just inconceivable to our minds today when we spend more than the next seven countries put together on defense. And so just became very interested in the question of how, in such a resource-starved army and such a small army, how did you develop the greatest generation of combat commanders, such as Eisenhower, Patton, Bradley, Truscott, and I would add, given the earlier conversation, former LSU Dean of Students Troy Middleton, who led the 8th Corps in Western Europe.
Yeah, he was LSU president as well, and he is mentioned in your book more than a few times. And He had more hours in combat than any general in U.S. history, I believe. And what was it about that war that made such outstanding generals?
Well, I think it was a multitude of factors. I think that, one, that the sheer scale of the war meant that more generals were going to become prominent, were going to become more household names. That you compare it to a war, say, even as big a war as Operation Iraqi Freedom, in which American forces only had one corps operating at a time. You had 40 different army corps commanders during World War II. Second, the nature of the warfare, that conventional warfare like that allowed more room for strategy, more room for operational genius than, say, today, modern warfares of asymmetric war, insurgencies. It's hard for a general to look good in an insurgency. Even Napoleon was stymied by guerrillas during the Peninsular Campaign in the early 1800s. I think a third thing that, for the historiography of it, is that there's a very different relationship with the media and war and the military now, that the American media was very much invested in winning the war and in elevating these men in the American awareness as part of boosting morale. You think that they actually, the American media, the reporters in Europe, helped to suppress the news of Patton slapping soldiers in the hospital. When there was a significant military morale crisis in 1941 before the war, the New York Times suppressed reports of that and actually went to Chief of Staff George Marshall, went to the president and gave them the report privately, said, we're not going to give Hitler the satisfaction of knowing there's this problem. It's difficult to imagine. I'm not saying the media shouldn't be a watchdog, but it's difficult thinking of, say, the McChrystal, the relief of General Stanley McChrystal, various other things, that the media would play the same role for generals.
The book is Generals in the Making, How Marshall, Eisenhower, Patton, and Their Peers Became the Commanders Who Won World War II, from Benjamin Runkle. And like most great comedians, have had great pain in their life, which may explain why they're funny. And these generals, the three that you showcase, along with others, many of them had many challenges as young people, and certainly the ones that are on the cover of the book, Marshall, Eisenhower, and Patton, they did not have totally idyllic childhoods, did they?
Well, it's not as much as their childhoods. I mean, Patton had an almost idyllic. He grew up very wealthy. But in the interwar years, each of these men, and I didn't know this going into when I started this project, and I don't think many people are aware of just how much personal tragedy they suffered. I mean, they all suffered professional setbacks of slow promotions, low salaries, difficult training situations or obsolete equipment. But they also dealt with a lot of personal tragedies that would, for a lot of people, would just sort of knock them on their rears. Eisenhower, in 1 year, his 3-year-old son died suddenly of scarlet fever, and he was very nearly court-martialed out of the army, which is hard to imagine, the Supreme Commander being court-martialed out of the army over a mistaken accepting of a housing allowance. Marshall similarly had his wife of 27 years died very suddenly and just left him heartbroken and, for the first time in his life, essentially alone, and had to struggle through that we get this impression of Marshall is a very cold and austere man, but if you see his letters to John Pershing or to other friends where he talks about his loneliness and pain, you get a very different impression of who Marshall was. And Patton very likely suffered from what we would today consider PTSD or traumatic brain injury. There was just no vocabulary for that in those days, and suffered from terrible midlife crisis that was filled with alcoholism, depression, and even his own daughter thought he was suicidally depressed before the war began, and he finally saw his chance to fulfill his self-appointed destiny as a great commander.
You mentioned that he was a wealthy young man. How did a person like Patton of privilege become such a so-called tough guy?
Well, Patton's family had a great military tradition. I mean, I would love someday to meet Winston Groom, because I have a feeling that he based the character Lieutenant Dan off of George Patton, in that George Patton had a relative who had been killed in every war leading up to World War I, going back to the Revolution, the Civil War, et cetera. So the Pattons had a very strong military tradition within their family, and he saw it as his self-appointed destiny to fulfill that mission of his family's. In fact, when he was wounded, very badly wounded in the Meuse-Argonne campaign in World War I, he claimed to have looked up to the sky and seen his deceased relatives looking down on him. So he came from such a strong military tradition and was raised steeped in military lore. As he told his future father-in-law, when his father-in-law said, "Why do you want to go into the Army? Why? That's not what a proper gentleman does." He says, "I can't explain it any more than I can explain why I need breath and how I draw breath. This is just who I am and how I feel about it."
These were very competitive men, weren't they?
Yes, they were. I think the competitiveness, it's interesting that I don't think there was as many personal rivalries as we think there are today. But in some circumstances, one, they were almost all athletes and had an innate competitiveness. Two, when they went to the command and general staff school in the 20s, most of them went in the 1920s, competition for placement in the school, for one, getting to the school and then you're standing as a student there, was so fierce that the pressure actually drove multiple students over the course of the two decades between the war.
All right, we've got a roll, but the book is Generals in the Making, How Marshall Eisenhower Patton and Their Peers Became the Commanders Who Won World War II, from Benjamin Runkle. Signature support from Brian Lowe Financial.